Are you going to clear her room now?
Louise nodded.
I'm going to make a start, she said. What will you do with her things? He asked, his voice rising even higher. He sounded strangled. Will you give them away?
No, darling. She went to him and reached out to smooth his soft hair from his forehead.
We'll keep everything. We won't give anything away.
He looked worried.
But shouldn't you wait for Dad? Shouldn't he be here? You shouldn't be doing this by yourself.
Louise smiled at him.
I'm just going to make a start, she said, as brightly as she could. I actually thought you'd gone round to Hugo's this morning, so...
Hugo was Josh's friend, possibly his only true friend. Every day, Louise thanked the Lord for the existence of Hugo and Hugo's family, who took Josh in whenever he needed an escape.
I did, but I forgot my phone, so I came back for it.
He held it up for her to see.
Okay, she said. Good boy. Are you staying there for lunch?
He nodded, and he tried to smile, and then he was gone. She waited until she heard the front door slam before she sat down on the bed and allowed herself to cry properly. On the bedside table there was an old hair tie, stretched and worn down almost to a thread. Long strands of Katie's glorious dark hair still entwined in it. Louise picked it up and turned it over in her hands, lacing it between her fingers. She held it against her face. She got to her feet and walked over to the dressing table, opened the heart-shaped pewter jewelry box and placed the hair tie inside. It would remain there along with her bracelets and earrings. Nothing would be thrown away. Everything would remain. Not here, but somewhere. It would travel with them. No part of Katie, nothing she had touched, would languish on a dusty charity shop shelf. Around Louise's neck hung the necklace which Katie had been wearing when she died, a silver chain with a little bluebird. It bothered Louise that she'd chosen that particular piece of jewellery. Louise hadn't thought it a favourite. Not like the white gold earrings which Louise and Alec had given her on her 13th birthday, which she'd adored. Not like the woven friendship bracelet, brotherhood bracelet, which Josh bought for her, with his own money, on their last holiday to Greece. Louise couldn't fathom why Katie had chosen that, a present from Lena, to whom she'd no longer seemed particularly close, the bird engraved, most un-Lena-like, with love. She'd worn no other jewellery. Jeans, a jacket, far too warm for the summer evening, its pockets filled with stones. Her backpack similarly laden. When they found her, she was surrounded by flowers, some of them still clutched in her fist. Like Ophelia. Like the picture on Nell Abbott's wall. People said it was tenuous at best, ridiculous and cruel at worst, to lay the blame at Nell Abbott's door for what happened to Katie. Just because Nell wrote about the pool, talked about the pool, took pictures there, conducted interviews, published articles in the local press, spoke once to a BBC radio programme about it, just because she said the words suicide spot, just because she talked about her beloved swimmers as glorious romantic heroines, as women of courage meeting easeful death in their chosen place of beauty, she could not be held responsible. But Katie didn't hang herself from the back of her bedroom door. She didn't cut her wrists or take a handful of pills. She chose the pool. What was truly ridiculous was to ignore that, to ignore the context, to ignore how suggestible some people can be, sensitive people, young people, teenagers, good, intelligent, kind children become intoxicated with ideas. Louise didn't understand why Katie did what she did. She never would. But she knew that her act hadn't happened in isolation. The grief counsellor she had seen for just 2 sessions told her that she shouldn't seek to know why, that she wouldn't ever be able to answer that question, that no one could, that in many cases where someone takes their own life, there isn't one reason why. Life just isn't that simple. Louise, despairing, had pointed out that Katie had no history of depression, she wasn't being bullied. They talked to the school, they went through her email, her Facebook. They found nothing but love. She was pretty. She was doing well in school. She had ambition, drive. She wasn't unhappy. Wild-eyed sometimes, excitable often. Moody? 15. Most of all, she wasn't secretive. If she had been in trouble, she would have told her mother. She told her mother everything. She always had. "She didn't keep things from me," Louise said to the counsellor, and she watched his eyes slide from her face. "That's what all parents think," he said quietly, "and I'm afraid all parents are wrong." Louise didn't see the counsellor again after that, but the damage had been done. A fissure had opened and guilt seeped through, a trickle at first and then a flood. She didn't know her daughter. That was why the necklace bothered her so much, not just because it came from Lena, but because it became a symbol for everything she didn't know about her daughter's life. The more she thought about that, the more she blamed herself for being too busy, for focusing too much on Josh, for failing so completely to protect her child. The tide of guilt rose and rose, and there was only one way to keep her head above it, to keep from drowning, and that was to find a reason, to point to it, to say, there, that was it. Her daughter made a senseless choice, but pockets filled with stones and hands grasping flowers, the choice had context. The context was provided by Nell Abbott. Louise placed the black suitcase on the bed, opened the wardrobe and began to slip Katie's clothes off their hangers. Her bright T-shirts, her summer dresses, the shocking pink hoodie she wore all last winter. Her vision blurred and she tried to think of something to stop the tears coming. She tried to find some image on which to fix her mind's eye. And so she thought of Nell's body. Broken in the water, and she took what comfort she could from that.
Sean. I was roused by the sound of a woman calling out, a desperate, faraway sound. I thought I must have dreamed it, but then I was jolted awake by banging, loud and close and intrusive and real. There was someone at the front door. I dressed quickly and ran downstairs, glancing at the clock in the kitchen as I passed. It was only just after midnight. I couldn't have been sleeping for more than half an hour. The hammering at the door persisted, and I could hear a woman calling my name, a voice I knew, but for a moment couldn't place. I opened the door. "Do you see this?" Louise Whittaker was shouting at me, red-faced and furious. "I told you, Sean! I told you there was something going on!" The "this" to which she referred was an orange plastic vial. The sort you get prescription drugs in, and on the side there was a label with a name. Danielle Abbott. "I told you," she said again, and then she burst into tears. I ushered her inside. Too late. Before I closed the kitchen door, I saw a light go on in the upstairs bedroom of my father's house. It took quite a while to understand what Louise was telling me. She was hysterical, her sentences running into each other and making no sense. I had to tease the information out of her gradually, one gulping, breathless, furious phrase at a time. They had decided at last to put the house on the market. Before viewings could start, she needed to clear out Katie's bedroom. She wasn't having strangers tramping through there, touching her things. She had made a start on it that afternoon. While she was packing away Katie's clothes, she had found the orange vial. She'd been removing a coat from a hanger. The green one, one of Katie's favourites. She'd heard a rattling noise. She'd slipped her hand into the pocket and discovered the bottle of pills. She was shocked, even more so when she saw that the name on the bottle was Nell's. She had never heard of the drug, Rimitol, before, but she looked it up on the internet and discovered that it was a kind of diet pill. The pills are not legally available in the UK. Studies in the United States have linked their use to depression and suicidal thoughts.
"You missed it!" she cried. "You told me she had nothing in her blood. You said Nell Abbott had nothing to do with it, but here..."
She banged her fist on the table, making the vial jump into the air.
"See? She was supplying my daughter with drugs, with dangerous drugs, and you let her get away with it."
It was strange, but all the time she was saying this, attacking me, I felt relieved, because now there was a reason. If Nell had supplied Katie with drugs, then we could point to that and say, "Look, there, that's why it happened. That's why a brilliant, happy young girl lost a life. That's why two women lost their lives." It was comforting. But it was also a lie. I knew it was a lie. "Her blood tests were negative, Louise," I said. "I don't know how long this Rimitol, I've no idea how long it stays in the system. We've no idea if this even is Rimitol, but..." I got to my feet, fetched a plastic sandwich bag from the kitchen drawer and held it out to Louise. She picked the vial up from the table and dropped it into the bag. I sealed it up. "We can find out."
"And then we'll know,"
she said, gulping for air again. The truth was, we wouldn't know. Even if there were traces of a drug in her system, even if there was something that had been missed, it wouldn't tell us anything definitive.
"I know it's too late," Louise was saying, "but I want this to be known. I want everyone to know what Nell Abbott did. Christ, she might have given pills to other girls. You need to speak to your wife about this. As head teacher, she should know someone's selling this shit in her school. You need to search the lockers. You need..."
"Louise," I sat down at her side. "Slow down. Of course we'll take this seriously. We will. But we have no way of knowing how this bottle came into Katie's possession. It's possible that Nell Abbott purchased the pills for her own use."
"And what? What are you saying? That Katie stole them? How dare you even suggest that, Sean? You knew her."
The kitchen door rattled. It sticks, especially after rain, and flew open. It was Helen, looking disheveled in tracksuit bottoms and a T-shirt, her hair uncombed.
"What's going on? Louise, what's happened?"
Louise shook her head, but said nothing. She covered her face with her hands. I got to my feet and spoke to Helen. "You should go on up to bed," I said, keeping my voice low. "There's nothing to worry about."
"But..."
"I just need to chat to Louise for a bit. It's all right. You go on upstairs."
"All right,"
she said warily, glancing down at the woman sobbing quietly at our kitchen table.
"If you're sure..."
"I am." Helen slipped quietly out of the kitchen, closing the door behind her as she left. Louise wiped her eyes. She was looking at me oddly, wondering, I suppose, where Helen had been. I could have explained. She doesn't sleep well. My father's an insomniac, too. Sometimes they sit up together, do crosswords, listen to the radio. I could have explained, but the prospect felt tiring all of a sudden. So instead I said, "I don't think Katie stole anything, Louise. Of course I don't. But she might have, I don't know, picked them up absent-mindedly. She might have been curious. You say they were in a coat pocket? Perhaps she picked them up and then forgot about them."
"My daughter didn't take things from other people's homes,"
Louise replied sourly, and I nodded. No point arguing this one. "I'll look into it, first thing tomorrow. I'll have these sent to the labs, and we'll look at Katie's blood tests again. If I missed something, Louise..." She shook her head.
"I know it doesn't change anything. I know it won't bring her back,"
she said quietly.
It would just help me to understand.
I see that. Of course I do. Would you like me to drive you home? I asked her. I can bring your car over in the morning. She shook her head again and gave me a shaky smile.
I'm okay, she said. Thank you.
The echo of her thanks, unwarranted, undeserved, rang out in the silence after she'd gone. I felt wretched and was grateful for the sound of Helen's footsteps on the stairs, grateful that I wouldn't have to be alone.
What's going on?
She asked me as she entered the kitchen. She looked pale and very tired, with circles like bruises under her eyes. She sat down at the table and reached for my hand.
What was Louise doing here?
She found something, I said. Something which she thinks might have had some bearing on what happened to Katie.
Oh, God, Sean, what?
I puffed out my cheeks. I shouldn't... probably shouldn't discuss it in detail just yet. She nodded and squeezed my hand.
Tell me,
when was the last time you confiscated drugs at school? She frowned.
Well, that little tow rag, Watson, Ian, had some marijuana taken off him at the end of term, but before that... oh, not for a while. Not for a long while. Back in March, I think. That business with Liam Markham.
That was pills, wasn't it?
Yes, ecstasy. Or something purporting to be ecstasy in any case. And Rohypnol. He was excluded.
I vaguely remembered the incident, though it's not the sort of thing I involve myself in. There's been nothing since. You haven't come across any diet pills, have you? She raised an eyebrow.
No. Nothing illegal in any case. Some of the girls take those blue ones. What do they call them? Ally, I think. It's available over the counter, although I don't think it's supposed to be sold to minors.
She wrinkled her nose.
It makes them horribly flatulent, but apparently that's an acceptable price to pay for a thigh gap.
To pay for a what? Helen rolled her eyes at me.
A thigh gap. They all want legs so skinny they don't meet at the top. Honestly, Sean, sometimes I think you live on a different planet.
She squeezed my hand again.
Sometimes I wish I lived there with you.
We went up to bed together for the first time in a long time. But I couldn't touch her. Not after what I'd done.
Wednesday the 19th of August. Erin. It took Harry the science guy about 5 minutes to find the email receipt for the diet pills and Nell Abbott's spam folder. As far as he could tell, she only bought the pills on one occasion. Unless, of course, she had another email account which was no longer in use.
Odd, isn't it?
Commented one of the uniforms, one of the older guys whose name I haven't bothered to learn.
She was such a thin woman. Wouldn't have thought she needed them.
The sister? She was the fat one.
Jules, I said, she isn't fat.
Oh, aye, not now, but you should have seen her back in the day.
He started laughing.
She was a heifer.
Fucking charming. Since Sean told me about the pills, I've been swatting up on Katie Whittaker. It was pretty clear-cut, although the question of why loomed large, as is so often the case. Her parents didn't suspect anything was up. Her teacher said that perhaps she'd been a little distracted, maybe a bit more reserved than usual, but there were no red flags. Her blood work was clean. She'd no history of self-harm. The only thing, and it wasn't much of a thing, was an alleged falling out with her best friend, Lena Abbott. A couple of Katie's school friends claimed that Lena and Katie had had a disagreement about something. Louise, Katie's mother, said they'd been seeing less of each other, but she didn't think there had been an argument. If there had been, she said, Katie would have mentioned it. They'd had fights in the past, teenage girls will do that, and Katie had always been upfront about it with her mum. And in the past, they'd always kissed and made up. After one fight, Lena had felt bad enough to give Katie a necklace.
These school friends, though, Tanya something and Ellie something else, said that something big was up, though they couldn't say what. All they knew was that a month or so before Katie died, she and Lena had what they called a vicious argument that ended in them being physically separated by a teacher. Lena hotly denied it, claiming Tanya and Ellie had it in for her, that they were just trying to get her into trouble. Certainly Louise had never heard of this row, and the teacher involved, Mark Henderson, claimed it wasn't really an argument at all. They were play fighting, he said, messing about. It got very noisy, and he told them to quieten down. And that was it. I skimmed over that when I was reading Katie's file, but I kept coming back to it. Something felt off. Do teenage girls play fight? It seems like something teenage boys would be more likely to do. Perhaps I've internalized more sexism than I care to admit. But I was just looking at pictures of those girls, pretty, poised, Katie in particular very well groomed, and they didn't look much like play fighters to me. When I parked the car outside the mill house, I heard a noise and glanced up. Lena was leaning out of one of the upstairs windows, a cigarette in her hand. "Hello, Lena," I called out. She didn't say anything, but very deliberately took aim and flicked the cigarette butt in my direction. Then she withdrew, slamming the window shut. I don't buy the play fighting thing at all. I imagine that when Lena Abbott fights, she fights for real. Jules let me in, glancing nervously over my shoulder as she did so. "Everything all right?" I asked her. She looked awful, haggard, grey, eyes bleary, hair unwashed. "I can't sleep," she said softly. "I just don't seem to be able to get to sleep." She shuffled through to the kitchen, flicked the kettle on, and slumped down at the table. She reminded me of my sister 3 weeks after she gave birth to her twins, barely enough strength to hold her head up. "Perhaps you ought to get the doctor to prescribe you something," I suggested, but she shook her head. "I don't want to sleep too deeply," she said, her eyes widening, giving her a manic cast. "I need to be alert." I could have said that I'd seen greater alertness from coma patients, but I didn't. "This Robbie Cannon you were asking about," I said. She twitched and chewed on a nail. "We had a little look into him. You're right about him being violent. He's got a couple of domestic violence convictions, among other things. But he wasn't involved in your sister's death. I went over to Gateshead, that's where he lives, and had a little chat with him. He was in Manchester visiting his son the night Nell died. He says he hasn't seen her in years, but when he read about her death in the local paper, he decided he would come up here to pay his respects. He seemed pretty gobsmacked that we were asking him about it at all."
"Did he?" Her voice was little more than a whisper. "Did he mention me? Or Lena?"
"No, he didn't."
"Why do you ask? Has he been here?"
I thought of the tentative way in which she'd opened the front door, the way she'd looked over my shoulder as though watching out for someone.
"No, I mean, I don't think so. I don't know."
I managed to get nothing more out of her on the subject. It was clear that she was frightened of him for some reason, but she wouldn't say why. It was unsatisfactory, but I left it at that, as I had another awkward subject to raise. "This is a bit difficult," I said to her. "I'm afraid we need to search the house again." She stared at me, horrified.
"Why? Have you found something? What's happened?"
I explained about the pills.
"Oh, God!"
She squeezed her eyes shut and hung her head.
It might have been exhaustion dulling her reaction, but she didn't seem shocked. She purchased them in November of last year, on the 18th, from an American website. We can't find a record of any other purchases, but we need to make sure. All right, she said. Of course. She rubbed her eyes with the tips of her fingers. A couple of uniforms will come round this afternoon. Is that okay? She shrugged. Well, if you have to, but I... What date did you say she bought them? The 18th of November, I said, checking my note. Why? It's just... That's the anniversary of our mother's death. It seems... Oh, I don't know. She frowned. It just seems odd, because Nell usually called me on the 18th, and last year was notable because she didn't. It turned out she was in hospital for an emergency appendectomy. I suppose I'm just surprised she would have been spending her time buying diet pills when she was in hospital for emergency surgery. You're sure it was the 18th? Back at the station, I checked with Harry. I was right about the date. She could have bought them on her mobile, Callie suggested. It is really boring in hospital. But Harry shook his head.
No, I've checked the IP address. Whoever made the purchase did so at 4:17 p.m., and they did so from a computer using the Mill House router, so it had to be someone in or near the house. Do you know what time she went into hospital?
I didn't, but it wasn't difficult to find out. Nell Abbott was admitted in the small hours of the 18th of November for an emergency appendectomy, just like her sister said. She remained in hospital all that day, and they kept her in overnight, too. Nell couldn't have bought the pills. They were purchased by someone else using her card in her home. Lena, I said to Sean. It's got to be Lena. He nodded, grim-faced.
We're going to need to talk to her.
You want to do it now? I asked him, and he nodded again.
No time like the present, he said. No time like immediately after the child has lost her mother.
Christ, this is a mess. And it was about to get messier. We were on our way out of the office when we were waylaid by an overexcited Callie.
The prince, she said breathlessly. They've got a match. Well, not quite a match, because there's no match to anyone who's come forward, only...
Only what? The DI snapped.
Some bright spark decided to take a look at the print on the pill bottle and compare it to the print on the camera, you know, the damaged one.
Yes, we remember the damaged camera, Sean replied.
Okay, well, they match, and before you see it, it's not Nell Abbott's print, and it's not Katie Whittaker's. Someone else handled both those objects.
Louise, Sean said.
It has to be. Louise Whittaker.
Mark. Mark was zipping up his suitcase when the detective arrived. A different detective this time. Another woman, a bit older and not so pretty. Dear Serin Morgan, she said, shaking his hand. I was wondering if I could have a word. He didn't invite her in. The house was a mess and he wasn't in the mood to be accommodating. I'm packing to go on holiday, he said. I'm driving to Edinburgh this evening to pick up my fiancé. We're going to Spain for a few days. It won't take long, D.S. Morgan said, her gaze slipping over his shoulder and into the house. He pulled the front door to. They spoke on the front step. He assumed it would be about Nell Abbott again. He was, after all, one of the last people to see her alive. He'd seen her outside the pub. They'd spoken briefly. He'd watched her head off towards the Mill House. He was prepared for that conversation. He wasn't prepared for this one. I know you've already been over this, but there are a few things we need to clarify, the woman said, about events leading up to the death of Katie Whittaker. Mark felt his pulse quicken. What about it? I understand that you had cause to intervene in an argument between Lena Abbott and Katie about a month before Katie died? Mark's throat felt very dry. He struggled to swallow. It wasn't an argument, he said. He held up his hand to shield his eyes from the sun. Why is this coming up again? Katie's death was ruled a suicide, I thought. Yes, the detective interrupted. Yes, it was, and that hasn't changed. However, we've come to understand that there might have been, circumstances surrounding Katie's death which we didn't know about before, and which may require further investigation. Mark turned abruptly, pushing the front door open so hard it rebounded onto him as he stepped into the hallway. The vice was tightening on his skull. His heart was pounding. He had to get out of the sun. Mr. Henderson, are you all right?
I'm fine.
His eyes adjusting to the darkness of the hallway, he turned back once more to look at her.
Fine. A bit of a headache, that's all. The glare, it's just...
Why don't we get you a glass of water? D.S. Morgan suggested with a smile.
No,
he replied, realizing even as he spoke how sullen he sounded.
No, I'm fine.
There was a silence. The argument, Mr. Henderson, between Lena and Katie? Mark shook his head. It wasn't an argument. I told the police this at the time. I didn't have to separate them, not in the way that was suggested. Katie and Lena were very close. They could be excitable and voluble, the way many girls of that age, children of that age, can be. The detective, still standing in the sunshine on the front step, was now a faceless outline, a shadow. He preferred her that way. Some of Katie's teachers reported that she seemed distracted, perhaps a bit more reserved than usual in the weeks running up to her death. Is that your recollection?
No, Mark said. He blinked slowly. No, I don't believe so. I don't believe that she had changed. I didn't notice anything different. I didn't see it coming. None of us saw this coming.
His voice was low and strained, and the detective noticed. I'm sorry to bring all this up again, she said. I understand how terrible...
I don't imagine that you do, actually. I saw that girl every day. She was young and bright and... She was one of my best students. We were all very... fond of her.
He stumbled over fond. I'm very sorry, I really am. But the thing is that some new facts have come to light, and we have to look into them. Mark nodded, struggling to hear her over the pounding of blood in his ears. His entire body felt very cold, as though someone had poured petrol all over him. Mr. Henderson, we have been led to understand that Katie may have been taking a drug, something called Rimato. Have you heard of it? Mark peered at her. Now he did want to see her eyes. He wanted to read her expression.
No, I thought they said that she hadn't taken anything. That was what the police said at the time. Rimato, what is that? Is that recreational?
Morgan shook her head. It's a diet pill, she said. Katie wasn't overweight, he said, realizing how stupid that sounded even as he said it. They talk about it all the time, though, don't they? Teenage girls, about their weight. And not just teenagers either, grown women too. My fiancé never shuts up about it.
True, though not the whole truth, because his fiancée was no longer his fiancée. She no longer moaned to him about her weight, nor was she waiting for him to pick her up to accompany him to Malaga. In her last email, sent some months ago now, she'd wished misery on him, told him she'd never forgive him for the way he'd treated her. But what had he done that was so terrible? If he'd been a truly awful man, a cold, cruel, unfeeling man, he'd have strung her along for appearance's sake. It would have been in his interests, after all. But he wasn't a bad man. It was just that when he loved completely. And what on earth was wrong with that?
After the detective left, he walked around the house, opening drawers, thumbing through the pages of books, looking. Looking for something he knew very well he wouldn't find. The night after Midsummer, angry and frightened, he'd built a fire in the back garden and had piled onto it cards and letters, a book, other gifts. If he looked out of the back window now, he could still see it. A little patch of scorched earth where he had eradicated every trace of her. As he pulled open the desk drawer in his living room, he knew exactly what he'd see, because this wasn't the first time he'd done it. He'd searched and searched for something he'd missed, sometimes in fear and often in grief. But he'd been thorough that first night. There were pictures, he knew, in the head's office at school. A file. Closed now, but still kept. He had a key to the admin block and he knew exactly where to look. And he wanted something. He needed something to take with him. This wasn't a triviality. It was essential, he felt, because the future was suddenly so uncertain. He hadn't thought it until now, but he had an inkling that when he turned the key in the back door, locking up the house, he might never do that again. Perhaps he wouldn't come back. Perhaps it was time to disappear, to start over. He drove to the school, parking in the empty car park. Sometimes Helen Townsend worked there during the school holidays, but there was no sign of her car today. He was alone. He let himself into the building and headed up past the staff room to Helen's office. Her door was closed, but when he tried the handle, he found it unlocked. He pushed the door open, breathing in the nasty chemical whiff of carpet cleaner. He crossed the room to the filing cabinet and pulled open the top drawer. It had been emptied, and the drawer below was locked. He realized with an acute sense of disappointment that someone had rearranged everything, that in fact he didn't know exactly where to look, that perhaps this had been a wasted journey. He darted out to the hallway to check that he was still alone. He was, his red Vauxhall still the only vehicle in the car park, and went back to the head's office. Taking care not to disturb anything, he opened Helen's desk drawers one by one, looking for the keys to the filing cabinet. He didn't find them, but he did find something else. A trinket he couldn't imagine Helen wearing. Something which struck him as vaguely familiar. A silver bracelet with an onyx clasp, and an engraving reading, S.J.A. He sat and stared at it for a long time. He couldn't for the life of him think what it meant, the fact that it was here. It meant nothing. It couldn't mean anything. Mark replaced the bracelet in the desk, abandoned his search and returned to his car. He had the key in the ignition when it struck him exactly when he'd seen that bracelet last. He'd seen it on Nell, outside the pub. They'd spoken briefly. He'd watched her head off towards the mill house. But before that, before she had left him, she had been fidgeting with something on her wrist as they spoke. And there. It was there. He retraced his steps. Went back to Helen's office and opened the drawer, took the bracelet and put it into his pocket. He knew as he was doing it that if someone asked him why, he wouldn't be able to explain himself. It was, he thought, as though he were in deep water, as though he were reaching for something, anything, to save himself. It was as though he had reached for a life buoy and instead found weeds, and grabbed hold of them anyway.
Erin. The boy, Josh, was standing outside the house when we arrived, like a little soldier on guard, pale and watchful. He greeted the DI politely, looking more suspiciously at me. He was holding a Swiss Army knife in his hand, his fingers working nervously around the blade as he opened and closed it.
"Is your mum in, Josh?"
Sean asked him, and he nodded. "Why do you want to talk to us again?" he asked, his voice rising with a sharp squeak. He cleared his throat.
"We just need to check a couple of things," Sean said. "It's nothing to worry about."
She was in bed,
Josh announced, his eyes flicking from Sean's face to mine.
That night, Mum was asleep. We were all asleep.
What night? I asked.
What night was that, Josh?
He blushed and looked down at his hands and fiddled with his knife. A little boy who hadn't learned yet how to lie.
His mother opened the door behind him. She looked from me to Sean and sighed, rubbing her fingers over her brows.
Her face was the colour of weak tea, and when she turned to talk to her son, I noticed that her back was hunched, like an old woman. She beckoned him to her, speaking quietly.
But what if they want to talk to me too?
I heard him asking. She placed her hands firmly on his shoulders.
They won't, darling, she said. Off you go.
Josh closed his knife and slipped it into his jeans pocket, his eyes on mine as he did. I smiled and he turned away, walking quickly down the path, glancing back just once as his mother was pulling the door closed behind us. I followed Louise and Sean into a big, bright living room, leading out into one of those boxy, modern conservatories which seemed to make the house bleed seamlessly into the garden. Outside, I could see a wooden hutch on the lawn and bantams, pretty black and white and golden hens, scratching around for food. Louise indicated for us to sit on the sofa. She lowered herself into the armchair opposite, slowly and carefully, like someone recovering from an injury, afraid of inflicting more damage.
So, she said, raising her chin slightly as she looked at Sean. What have you got to tell me?
He explained that the new blood tests gave the same results as the original ones. There were no traces of drugs in Katie's system. Louise listened, shaking her head in clear disbelief.
But you don't know, do you, how long that sort of drug stays in the system? Or how long it takes for the effects to manifest or to wear off? You can't dismiss this, Sean.
We're dismissing nothing, Louise, he said evenly. All I'm telling you is what we have found.
Surely... Well, surely supplying illegal drugs to someone, to a child, is an offence in any case. I know...
She grazed her teeth over her lower lip. I know it's too late to punish her, but it should be made known, don't you think? What she did. Sean said nothing. I cleared my throat, and Louise glared at me as I began to speak.
From what we've discovered, Mrs. Whittaker, regarding the timing of the purchase of the pills, Nell could not have purchased them. Although her credit card was used, it...
What are you suggesting? A voice rose angrily.
Now you're saying Katie stole her credit card?
No, no, I said. We're not saying anything of the sort. Her face changed as realization dawned on her.
Lena,
she said, leaning back in her chair, her mouth fixed in grim resignation. Lena did it.
We didn't know that for sure either, Sean explained, though we would certainly be questioning her about it. In fact, she was due to visit the station that afternoon.
He asked Louise whether she'd found anything else of concern amongst Katie's possessions. Louise dismissed the question bluntly.
This is it, she said, leaning forward. Can't you see that? You combine the pills and this place and the fact that Katie spent so much time round at the Abbotts, surrounded by all those pictures and those stories, and...
She tailed off. Even she didn't seem entirely convinced by the story she was telling. Because even if she was right, and even if those pills had made her daughter depressed, none of it changed the fact that she hadn't noticed.
I didn't say that, of course, because what I had to ask was difficult enough.
Louise was hauling herself to her feet, assuming our meeting to be over, expecting us to leave, and I had to stop her.
There's something else we need to ask you about, I said.
Yes,
She remained standing, her arms crossed over her chest.
"We wondered if you would be prepared to let us take your fingerprints,"
she interrupted before I could explain.
"What for? Why?"
Sean shifted uneasily in his chair. "Louise, we have a matching print from the pill bottle you gave me and from one of Nell Abbott's cameras, and we need to establish why. That's all." Louise sat back down.
"Well, they're probably Nell's," she said. "Wouldn't you imagine?"
"They're not Nell's," I replied.
"We've checked. They're not your daughter's, either."
She flinched at that.
"Of course they're not Katie's. What would Katie be doing with the camera?"
She pursed her lips, raising her hand to the chain around her neck, running the little bluebird back and forth. She sighed heavily.
"Well, they're mine, of course," she said. "They're mine."
It happened 3 days after her daughter died, she told us.
"I went to Nell Abbott's house. I was... well, I doubt you can imagine the state I was in, but you can try. I beat on her front door, but she wouldn't come out. I wouldn't give up. I just stayed there, pounding on the door and calling out for her, and eventually," she said, sweeping a strand of hair from her face, "Lena opened the door. She was crying, sobbing, practically hysterical. It was quite a scene." She tried and failed to smile. "I said some things to her. Cruel things, I suppose, in retrospect, but..."
"What sort of things?" I asked.
I don't really remember the details."
Her composure was starting to slip, her breath shortening, her hands gripping the sides of her armchair, the effort turning the olive skin over her knuckles to yellow.
"Nell must have heard me. She came outside and told me to leave them alone. She said..."
Louise gave a yelping laugh.
"She said that she was sorry for my loss. She was sorry for my loss, but it had nothing to do with her, nothing to do with her daughter."
Lena was on the ground. I remember that. She was making a noise like an animal.
A wounded animal.
She paused to catch her breath before continuing.
"We argued, Nell and I. It was rather violent."
She half smiled at Sean.
"You're surprised? You've not heard this before. I thought Nell would have told you about it, or Lena at least. Yes, well, I didn't hit her, but I lunged at her and she held me off. I demanded to see the footage from her camera. I didn't want to see it, but I wanted more than anything for her not to have... I couldn't bear..."
Louise broke down. Watching someone in the throes of raw grief is a terrible thing. The act of watching feels violent, intrusive, a violation. Yet we do it. We have to do it all the time. You just have to learn to cope with it whatever way you can. Sean coped by bowing his head and remaining very still. I coped with distraction. I watched the chickens scratching around on the lawn outside the window. I looked at the bookshelves, my eyes passing over worthy contemporary novels and military history books. I took in the framed pictures above the fireplace, the wedding photo, and the family shot, and the photograph of a baby. Just one, a little boy in blue. Where was Katie's picture? I tried to imagine what it would feel like to take the framed picture of your child down from its place of pride and put it in a drawer. When I looked over at Sean, I saw that his head was no longer bent. He was glowering at me. I realized that there was a tapping sound in the room and that it was coming from me. The sound of my pen knocking against my notepad. I wasn't doing it deliberately. I was shaking all over. After what seemed like a very long time, Louise spoke again. I couldn't bear for Nell to be the last one to see my child. She told me there was no footage, that the camera wasn't working, that even if it had been, it was up on the cliff, so it wouldn't have captured her. She heaved a huge sigh, a shudder working itself through her entire body, from her shoulders to her knees. I didn't believe her. I couldn't risk it. What if there was something on camera and she used it? What if she showed my girl to the world, alone and frightened and... She stopped and took a deep breath. I told her... Lena must have told you all this. I told her that I wouldn't rest until I saw her pay for what she'd done. Then I left. I went to the cliff and tried to open the camera to get the SD card out of it, but I couldn't. I tried to break it free from its mount. I ripped my fingernail out doing so. She held up her left hand. The nail of her forefinger was stunted and buckled. I kicked it a few times. I smashed at it with a stone. Then I went home. Erin. Josh was sitting on the pavement opposite the house as we left. He watched us walking towards the car, crossing the road quickly once we got 50 yards or so down the street, and disappearing into the house. The DI, in his own world, didn't seem to notice. She wouldn't rest until she saw Nell pay, I repeated when we reached the car. Does that not sound like a threat to you? Sean regarded me with his familiar blank expression, his irritating look of not really there-ness. He said nothing. I mean, doesn't it seem odd that Lena wouldn't even mention that to us? And Josh? That business about them all being asleep? It was such an obvious lie. He nodded curtly.
Yes, it seems so. But I wouldn't set too much store by the tales of grieving children, he said quietly. There's no telling what he's feeling or imagining, or what he thinks he should or shouldn't be saying. He knows that we know that his mother bore a grudge against Nell Abbott, and I imagine he's afraid that she's going to be blamed, that she's going to be taken away from him. You have to think about how much he's already lost.
He paused.
As for Lena, if she truly was as hysterical as Louise suggests, she may not even remember the incident clearly. She may remember very little other than her own distress.
For my part, I was finding it difficult to marry Louise's description of Lena that day, a howling, wounded beast, with the usually self-contained and occasionally venomous girl we had encountered. It seemed bizarre to me that her reaction to her friend's death would be so extreme, so visceral, when her reaction to her mother's was so restrained. Was it possible that Lena had been so affected by Louise's grief, by Louise's conviction that Nell was to blame for Katie's death, that she had come to believe it herself? A prickle ran over my skin. It didn't seem likely, but what if, like Louise, Lena blamed her mother for Katie's death? And what if she decided to do something about that?
Lena. Why do adults always ask the wrong questions? The pills. That's what they're all on about now. Those stupid fucking diet pills. I'd forgotten I even bought them. It was so long ago. And now they've decided that the pills are the answer to everything. And so I had to go to the police station with Julia, who is my appropriate adult. That made me laugh. She's like the least appropriate adult possible for this particular situation. They took me into a room at the back of the police station, which was not like what you see on television. It was just an office. We all sat around a table and that woman, D.S. Morgan, asked the questions. Mostly. Sean asked some too, but mostly it was her. I told the truth. I bought the pills on Mum's card because Katie had asked me to. And neither of us had any clue they were bad for you. Or I didn't, in any case. And if Katie did, she never said anything to me about it. You don't seem particularly concerned, D.S. Morgan said, that they might have contributed to Katie's negative state of mind at the end of her life. I nearly bit through my tongue. No, I told her. I'm not concerned about that. Katie didn't do what she did because of any pills. So why did she? I should have known she'd seize on that. So I kept talking. She didn't even take that many, a few. Probably not more than 4 or 5. Count the pills, I said to Sean. I'm pretty sure the order was for 35. Count them. We will, he said. Then he asked, did you supply pills to anyone else? I shook my head. He wouldn't leave it at that. This is important, Lena. I know it is, I told him. That was the only time I bought them. I was doing a favor for a friend. That was all it was. Honestly. He leaned back in his chair. Ulrich, he said. The thing I'm struggling to understand is why Katie would want to take pills like that at all. He looked at me, and then at Julia, as though she might know the answer. It's not as though she was overweight. Well, she wasn't thin, I said. And Julia made a strange noise, like a cross between a snort and a laugh. And when I looked at her, she was looking back at me like she hated me. Did people say that to her? D.S. Morgan asked me. At school? Were there comments made about her weight? Jesus! I was finding it so hard not to lose my temper. No, Katie wasn't being bullied. You know what? She used to call me skinny bitch all the time. She used to laugh at me because, you know... I got embarrassed because Sean was looking right at me. But I'd started, so I had to finish. Because I've got no boobs. She called me skinny bitch, and sometimes I replied with fat cow, and neither of us meant it. They didn't get it. They never do. And the problem was, I couldn't explain it all properly. Sometimes I didn't even understand myself. Because although she wasn't thin, it really didn't bother her. She never talked about it the way others did. I've never had to try, but Amy and Ellie and Tanya did. Always low-carbing or fasting or purging or whatever the fuck. But Katie didn't care. She liked having tits. She liked the way her body looked. Or at least she always used to. And then... I honestly don't know what it was. Some stupid comment on Insta or a dumb remark from some Cro-Magnon at school, and she got weird about it. That was when she asked me for the pills. But by the time I'd got them, she seemed to be over it. And she said they didn't work anyway. I thought the interview was over. I thought I'd made my point. And then D.S. Morgan went off on a completely different tangent, asking me about the day Louise came round, just after Katie died. I was like, yes, of course I remember that day. It was one of the worst days of my life. I still get upset just thinking about it. I've never seen anything like that, I told them. Like the way Louise was that day. She nodded. Then she asked all earnest, all concerned. When Louise said to your mother that she wouldn't rest until she saw Nell pay, how did you take that? What did you think she meant by that? I lost it then. She didn't mean anything, you fucking moron. Lena, Sean was glaring at me. Language, please. Well, I'm sorry, but for God's sake, Louise's daughter had just died. She didn't even know what she was saying. She was crazy. I was ready to leave, but Sean asked me to stay. I don't have to, though, do I? I'm not under arrest, am I? Nor, Lena. Of course you're not, he said. I spoke to him because he understood. Look, Louise wasn't serious. She was totally hysterical, off her head. You remember, don't you?